Well, good day and welcome to today's episode. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode here of the Disaster Podcast for you. And, of course, lots of things going on. We're up into the Greek letters and continuing on, and the season's not over for hurricanes, so we'll be talking about that and a whole lot more. But, of course, we can't have any discussion at all without co-host Sam Bradley, who just keeps us all straight here on the show.
Well, yeah, the world will end if I wasn't here, right?
It's not too far off the mark.
I know, it's 2020, anything's possible. Well, we got our Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Joe.
Hello, everyone. It's great to be here again tonight. Thanks.
Well, we're glad you're here. And we have one of our favorite guests who we will get to in a moment. But first, we got a lot of weather going on. And thank God Becky's here to tell us about the storm coming in tomorrow and everything else out there. Miss Becky.
Yeah, so we have Hurricane Delta, currently a hurricane. I'm like you, Jamie, a Category 3 hurricane. As you can tell, Delta is not a normal name, so we have entered the Greek alphabet. We had Gamma before this. Unfortunately, Delta is going to take a fairly similar track to Hurricane Laura, which made landfall in southwestern Louisiana last month and cause some damage over an area that's already struggling. There was a picture that went out taken from a plane that showed all these blue squares over the land, and they're not swimming pools. Those are blue tarps over roofs that have not yet been replaced or fixed from when Laura made landfall last month. So unfortunately, they are bracing once again for a pretty strong storm, somewhere between a 2 and a 3, most likely gonna, I think it's a 2 right now, actually, but it's expected to strengthen as storms do in the Gulf of Mexico, because there's a lot of warm water and low wind shear. So pretty strong winds, a lot of rain, a lot of storm surge. Not going to be a good situation for that immediate coastline right there in southeastern Louisiana, but also spreading wind and rain pretty far inland. Most of Louisiana is going to experience tropical storm force winds, rainfall up to a foot across a good chunk of Louisiana from this storm. And again, obviously that storm surge right along the coast, expecting anywhere from 6 to 10 foot storm surge. So, yeah, keep them in your thoughts and prayers if you are the praying type, because they are going through a lot right now.
Oh, my God. Jamie, you had a comment on that.
Well, I'm just looking forward to the second half of the show, or the second part of the show, when we have Dan come on and talk, because having two storms back to back like this really stresses the infrastructure and the building structural components. Maybe your roof survived Laura, but maybe got loosened up or somehow otherwise weakened so that it's more susceptible. I'll be interested to hear more about that as Dan gets into it. So, and as Becky pointed out, debris piles picked up and thrown around by the wind as it comes in. So there's a lot of stuff out there that's going to make this a really tough event for some people that have already been hit. So. Oh, and the latest hurricane category advisory is putting it at a Category 3 at the time we record this on Thursday night. So thanks, Dan, for that update. Lots going on.
115 mile per hour sustained, says Dan. We got to get him on because he's in his adventure shed going crazy because there's so much to talk about. But first, Bex, what else is out there? This is crazy. I mean, is there anything else brewing? There's so many. I get so many notices all day about this storm and that storm, and it's upgraded and it's downgraded, and I've lost my mind. So hopefully you haven't.
I'd plead the fifth on that. there is some other things out in the eastern Pacific. There's Tropical Depression Norbert. And then on the five-day outlook for the Atlantic, there is unfortunately an area of interest that we are watching. Currently well off the coast, the western coast of Africa. So, there's a... October is a bit of a... scary month for tropical systems. You just never really quite know what's going to happen. And a lot of times you can get recurving tropical systems, which unfortunately can mean more impacts for the eastern coast of the U.S. So definitely do not let your guard down yet. If you are anywhere along the coast, keep that emergency kit and hurricane go bag at the ready.
Well, we sure feel sorry for those folks. I mean, anybody that gets hit by a hurricane, but especially when you get a double whack. And I loved your question, Jamie, in terms of, you know, how is one storm after another going to weaken the infrastructure? So, Joe, what does the federal deployment look like for Delta?
Yes, welcome, everyone. And my lovely wife is deployed with the human remains dog. And they are in Louisiana tonight in preparation. There are several FEMA teams in the area staging around that same part of Louisiana there, with the plan of probably being busy back in the same locations where we've been. This will be our third time this 4-week period over these storms. So definitely going a little crazy down there.
Oh, my God. What does it look like for you going out? Do you know yet?
I am on the sort of reserve list right now. My team is actually not up, and so I'm just supplying backup right now. Currently, I'm at home dog sitting. So,
well, somebody's got to do that. That's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Joe. So, Dan Zahner, oh, boy, did we pick the right night to have you on.
I was wondering, like, huh, I wonder why I got sick a little while ago and couldn't get on last week, and now I know why.
Well, somebody planned it this way. That's all I can tell you. Well, yeah. Dan is with NERI, if you've heard him before. If not, we'll teach you about all the different mnemonics we're going to go through. But it has a lot to do with structures. And I love Jamie's question, and I think that's a good place to start. Because I don't know that there's been too many cases of one storm after another before they had any kind of recovery. Becky mentioned debris piles. What the heck? Because I know you guys did a lot of reconnaissance prior to Laura. So that probably told you something. So we want to talk about all of that. But let's answer Jamie's question first, because I think that's an important one.
Well, thanks for having me on again, guys. It's always a pleasure to talk with the crew from the Disaster Podcast. It has been a really crazy few weeks. I was looking at our report from our friends at STEER, the Structural Extreme Reconnaissance Extreme Events Reconnaissance Team. They put together a magnificent report back at a couple weeks ago. If anybody wants to look at that, it's available on designsafe-ci.org, and you can just search for STEER there. But as you said, they did a ton of reconnaissance. I mean, back and forth across the area around Cameron, Louisiana, Lake Charles, Port Arthur, Texas, Beaumont, Texas, that area, with drones and street view cameras and you know, a bit of door-to-door socially distance, of course. And a lot of things that they found were really interesting. Especially they've teamed up with our colleagues down at University of Florida, Texas Tech, University of Illinois, my alma mater, Oski Wow Wow. They put a bunch of measurement devices in the path of Hurricane Laura that got really close to the track of the hurricane, and were able to measure some extremely high sustained winds and gusts of over 150 miles an hour in some cases. But what they found was that the area that Laura hit has been one of the most highly developed in the past few decades since the 1980s. And we talk about in the hazards engineering community a few different aspects of what happens that turns a hazard in event into a disaster. And one of those is exposure, as well as so. The amount of people and the amount of built up infrastructure that's actually exposed to the hazard. And that's unfortunately a really big thing in the southeastern United States. A lot of people like to build a lot of homes next to the coast. And the more people that do that, the more risk there is. And so what they found is that the wind speeds were estimated to have reached or exceeded the design wind speeds for buildings and other structures as defined in the building code by as much as 5 miles an hour, which is pretty significant in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And so they were able to see that a design level event hitting these homes. And the ones that have been built since the 80s after previous hurricanes have hit, they fared a lot better because they were built to a stricter building code in Louisiana than were there previously. So we'll see how they do on the second round. We'll find, a lot of those older homes that are going to be the ones with the blue tarps on, and ones that were built to the newest stringent code will probably be okay.
Well, it'll be really interesting for you guys to see that, because it's kind of unique in some respects.
Yeah.
Becky made a side comment. There is no such thing as a natural disaster. It's only a disaster because people live there and build their homes there. And that's really true. I mean, but if that wasn't true, then you wouldn't have a job, Dan.
Well, I'd be doing something different, yeah.
Yeah. So you are the scheduling and operations coordinator for NERI. So you want to explain what NERI is?
Yeah, so NERI is funded by a grant from the National Science Foundation, our friends out in Alexandria, Virginia. Thank you to Joy Pauschke, our program officer. And we're the Natural Hazards Engineering Research Infrastructure. And so what that means is we're a consortium of universities. I'm headquartered at Purdue here in West Lafayette, Indiana. And we work with everyone from our friends down at the University of Florida and Florida International University with their wind tunnels, who are especially active during hurricane season. And we have some folks on the West Coast working on earthquake and geotechnical engineering on shake tables and geotechnical centrifuges at UC Davis and UC San Diego. We have the Rapid Deployment Facility, which is up at the University of Washington in Seattle, but they send equipment all over the place, and especially after hazard events, they're the ones who send out the drones and the street view cameras and the LIDAR scanners and all the really fun toys to categorize the area around the event after all is said and done, or sometimes even beforehand. They'll have equipment sent out to be able to see what the area is like as a hurricane comes in. They'll be able to do kind of before and after imagery of different types. So got a lot of different tools, and especially large scale, world-class testing facilities that are aimed at helping society become more resilient to all of these hazards that nature throws at us, except for fire. We don't deal with fire because that's another flavor of government money that NIST deals with.
I was just going to ask that, because with all the wildfires, I was wondering if there's anything about structural resilience in the face of wildfires, but
funnily
I wondered
enough
if that was NFPA or something like that. So.
Yeah, so that's NFPA and NIST, as well as some insurance agencies that deal with the fire part of it. But we do partner really closely with NIST in a lot of ways, and some of our projects do kind of overlap a bit. I was we'll step out of the hurricane season for a second here. One of the projects that I've been really excited about that's coming up in summer 2021 is the recommissioning of the newly upgraded UC San Diego shake table. They're upgrading to 6 degrees of freedom, which means that instead of just being able to go left and right, they'll be able to go up and down and back and forward at a magnitude 9 earthquake. Yeah. And you could put 10 million pounds of stuff on top of their 40-foot by 30-foot table. It's really cool. But this project that they're going to put on it is a 10-story tall cross-laminated timber building. So imagine plywood, but instead of little sheets of veneer laid on top of each other, it's 2x4s. And we make big panels out of that, build a building out of it. And what they're testing is a way to build with that very sustainable material in a way that's seismically resilient. They have these big walls that rock back and forth and absorb the energy of a seismic event and then just settle back into place into equilibrium once the shaking's done, with minimal to no damage.
That's fascinating. I'd love to see that.
It's going to be really cool. But one of the things I was talking about with them was, okay, you've got this big wooden structure, what about fire? Well, it's actually more fire resistant than a typically built wood frame structure, like the one I'm in right now in my adventure shed or the house. You know, typical stick built construction has a lot of air in it. And if you know from, you know, Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, the fire triangle, you know, the three things that a fire needs are air, fuel, and heat. So if you got a lot of air, you got a lot of potential for fire there. But with a cross-laminated timber structure, it's very densely packed, really big pieces of wood that are actually fairly hard to ignite. So it was really interesting to hear the researchers who are talking about that, of it's not only advantageous in a seismic way, but also against fire.
Well, that's good to know. But I'm just glad I don't live in California anymore. God forbid, knock on wood, that they have an earthquake now in what's left of the state.
Right.
Of course, we have that here in Colorado. We have one that's been burning since August. Oof. And we get every day, every single day, we get the air quality alerts. So I can only imagine how much worse it is in certain areas of California.
Yeah, it's been nuts. Some of our one of our facilities is at Oregon State University, and they've had to go back to working from home, not because of COVID, but because of dangerous air quality. Like, they weren't able to go onto the university campus because the all the HVAC filters getting clogged.
Oh, my God. I know they have to change them all the time. Crazy. Not a thing that we really thought too much about.
Hashtag 2020.
Oh, my God. Well, we'll get back to 2020. Becky, any questions so far for Dan?
A lot, but I'm not even sure where to start. What I'm familiar with in regards to this is IBHS, the hail study, and they do stuff with like wildfire and how hail impacts. Are you familiar with that group?
A bit, yeah. They kind of got the one-stop shop for testing everything, if I remember right. They're in South Carolina. I only know enough about them to be conversationally dangerous.
I love that term.
Oh yeah, definitely. So how does your work like directly relate? I mean, if I'm following all this correctly, what you do helps structures be better prepared to withstand anything, or hurricanes, earthquakes?
Yeah. So the advantage of our facilities, we do more fundamental research. So it's not developing products. It's not necessarily that, but it's things that will be incorporated into the building code in the next 5 to 10 years. But because we're a nationwide network of facilities, we can look at different types of hazards and how they relate to each other. Especially, you know, wind and waves. We've got coastal research facilities at Oregon State University who take inputs from our wind tunnels to be able to say, okay, we're one of the research projects they're looking at is elevated evacuation structures for tsunami. But then they're able to, you know, test that in their wave flume, see all the wave actions against it, and use a very similar test specimen to test for storm surge for elevated structures. And then take that same specimen and chuck it over to Miami, to Florida International University, and test it in the wind tunnel at 160 miles an hour to see how it does in a hurricane environment. So they work very closely together on a number of projects where these hazards overlap.
Oh, my God. Did you have another question, Beck?
Well, now I have like 10 more.
That's what I was afraid of. That you two are like, you know, what you two do is so strongly aligned, it makes perfect sense. We'll throw out another one.
So I'm kind of scared to ask this, but what's the current status of homes, you know, that are in that are in hazardous locations and prone to either hurricanes or earthquakes or tsunamis, which thankfully don't occur too often in the U.S., but like what I feel like a lot of where we've built has been prior to a lot of these codes being enforced.
Yeah, and as a good engineer, I will say it depends. You know, you've got places like Texas who, God bless them, they love their independence, but that also means they don't love building codes, and that leaves them very susceptible to damage and instances like we saw in Hurricane Harvey. places like Louisiana, they're a little bit further along, but you know, still not quite to the level of Florida in their building code for wind hazards. And even in any of those three areas, if you have a home built before the building code was enacted, it's very vulnerable. There are still things that homeowners can do to retrofit their homes, you know, adding hurricane strapping into your roof structure, making sure that you update your roof, you add in retrofitted windows with storm-related rated shutters, or the biggest one being your garage door, making sure that's a fortified, you know, hurricane-rated garage door, and just, you know, a lot of different things that you can do to tie the load path between the roof to the foundation of your structure, even in a renovation setting. So there are still things that you can do for older homes, but just, you know, like anything, just takes some time, a little bit of money. I was talking with a guy at Florida International University. His name is Eric Salna. You would love him. He's a meteorologist. He's the PR guy for the Wall of Wind. And we are actually releasing an interview on our podcast, Design Safe Radio, coming out in a few weeks, talking about this very thing. But definitely check out Eric. And he talks about putting together a 5-year disaster hazard mitigation plan. If you're in one of these areas and you've got an older home before the building code was updated for you know, wind hazard, especially, you know, maybe this year you tackle the garage door, next year you tackle the windows, year after that you get a new roof, you know, maybe pay for that for a couple of years, add in some hurricane straps the last year, and you know, after 5 years you've got a pretty well fortified home.
Good point. It's better than doing nothing and just hoping for the best. Becky made a side comment. There's so much damage that comes from the garage door failing in high wind events.
Yeah.
Why would that be, Dan?
So we'll get to some elementary physics here. So you have a really large area that's exposed to a wind force pushing on it. And when you have a really large force pushing over a really large area, that puts a lot of stress on that particular part of your building envelope. And the damage that comes from hurricanes can only really happen when there's a breach in the way that your house keeps the pressure of the wind out. And one of the biggest ways to let wind in is when your garage door fails. And so all that pressure pushing on a very large surface area is a huge amount of force. And if you've got an older garage door or one like the one out here in my shed that doesn't have any reinforcing or bracing on it, those will buckle like very quickly. And then you have a massive amount of open area for wind to come in and push out from the inside of your house to push your roof off, push out windows, all sorts of things that you definitely don't want happening. And even along with the wind, one of the largest areas of damage in homes is rain and water intrusion. If aside from the storm surge hazard, which is another aspect of hurricanes as well, but you have if you have that pressure boundary breached, even without your roof coming off, you can get a bunch of rain coming in behind your walls, which can do tons of damage to your drywall. I mean, we saw that. I'm also a volunteer with Team Rubicon, and did a deployment to Beaumont, Texas area after Hurricane Harvey. And we saw so many houses that just had rot and bugs and all sorts of things from water intrusion, even where they didn't have storm surge effects. But just, you know, the water got in, got everything wet, and they were evacuated and hadn't been in the house for a month. And you get a lot of creepy crawlies in a month.
Well, we got two people chafing at the bit to make a comment. You inspire them, Dan, I tell you. So, Jamie?
No, I just remember, our house is about 23 years old here in Maryland. And I remember right after we moved in, we had a hurricane come up the bay and hit our area. Power was out for like 5 days. I think it was one of the Glorias. It's hard to remember which name it was at the time, but it was, I remember we had water in our basement and we're on a hill, and I really never really thought I'd have a problem with a wet basement, But I went out and looked where it was coming in, and the wind had changed direction, as you know, the storm does when it moves over an area. And I had waves, literal waves, about an inch high, lapping uphill against my foundation. And that's where the water was coming in.
Yep.
It just was bizarre. So I mean, you're right about water intrusion. The storm drives the water in places you'd never expect it to come in.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. There's a lot of modeling that goes into what we do as well. Some of our colleagues down at University of Texas at Austin, the Texas Advanced Computing Center, and partnering with a group that has developed a tool called AdCirc, they actually model this phenomenon of storm surge. And you can look right now. I'm actually looking at this website is cera.coastalrisk.live, and they run this every time a hurricane advisory comes out. It's automatic, and it puts through a bunch of code to a supercomputer that I don't pretend to understand. But what it comes out with is a prediction of the storm surge, and it is based on the topography. It's based on the meteorological inputs from the storm, the storm latest storm track, all the things. And you can see just how high the maximum water height is predicted to be in all these little inlets and things around. You know, I'm looking at Lake Charles and the wildlife refuge around the Rockefeller Wildlife Refuge. They're looking to get over 10 to 12 feet. It's crazy. But what they've found is that as their modeling capabilities get better over the years, they're actually really accurate. And they found the storm surge data for Hurricane Laura was in excess of 10 feet over land in areas of east of Cameron, Louisiana, with estimates of upwards of 15 feet in some locations. And that was pretty close to their simulated estimates as the storm was coming in.
Oh, my goodness. I know Becky's loving that. She just put up a link to Sarah.
Yeah, that's it.
There it
is. It's free. It's open to the public. So if you're a data geek like me, you know, you can watch the storm roll in and really see the best of the best of the data that, you know, professionals can use. I actually remember back to Hurricane Harvey. A friend of mine was asking about, okay, you know, when should my dad evacuate his house? He didn't have an evacuation order and he lived in Beaumont, Texas. I was like, well, let's look at the data. And between this and some USGS, U.S. Geological Survey water meters, we could see one that was close to his house. And based on the rain that was coming, they gave a forecast of how high the water was going to get and when it was going to start to recede. And, you know, be able to say, yeah, you should probably get him to a higher part of the house and maybe think of moving out there because it's going to get up to his roof. That kind of thing. Ooh. So it's good to be able to have good data in real time as much as you can.
And it's good to have a son that knows this stuff.
Yeah.
Joe, you had a comment.
Yeah, I was just, you know, as I listened to this, I guess I had a couple of thoughts here. One of those is when we were in Lake Charles, Cameron, and other areas where the, you know, predicted storm surges were pretty impressive, we also noted storm surges that were quite a bit higher, I think, than even the locals expected, and were much more in line with those predictions than originally anticipated. And then the other thought I had was sort of the unique challenges as I listened to testing on structure and all that sort of stuff. You know, you sort of open a Pandora's box with that, in that in the Lake Charles area, southwestern Louisiana area, you have homes that are now structurally damaged that are about to be put under those same stresses again and are going to perform much differently this time.
Oh, because yeah.
Damages have not been fixed yet. There are breaches in the envelope of the home. You know, et cetera. Trees are down, so, you know, less wind gets blocked, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it adds so many additional layers of complexity from the prediction standpoint now, because the structures are not at baseline. They are deteriorated, and you're trying to, you know, put your estimates out there based on structures that are in pretty good shape, and these are obviously not.
Yeah, it's a huge task, and especially to educate the public about, you know, yeah, you may have ridden out Hurricane Laura okay, but next. This is different. It, you know, and even then, I mean, that the U.S. death toll on Hurricane Laura is still 26 people. And, you know, 8 of those were people running their generator inside when they shouldn't. You know, some others were plumes of chlorine gas from a chemical plant fire with, you know, like you said, the building envelope had been compromised. And even with your windows closed, you get some of that in there and it will really mess you up. So there's considerations that, you know, when we say this with every hurricane, it seems like some people just don't want to heed the evacuation orders and they pay for it.
Yeah, no doubt. Becky, your turn.
I just want to make a comment about how hard it is to make it tangible. Like, I can look at this data and sort of have a general idea of what this means, right? But to try and get the public to understand what 10 feet of water looks like, how do you even, like, get that image in their head? And the Weather Channel is doing a lot of stuff with VR and trying to, like, visualize that with, you know, a person standing and showing it coming above their head. But unless I'm not a social scientist, I've just sort of observed this, you know, over a decade of forecasting, but unless people have experienced something for themselves, it's very hard for them to perceive that risk. So we saw this with Sandy and with Irene. People went through Irene and were like, this is no big deal. I can ride this out on the Jersey Shore. It's going to be fine. And then Sandy hit and it was a whole different storm.
Oh, yeah.
We see this all the time. And I'm a little afraid we're going to see it with this situation, with people just having gone through Laura. And if they didn't experience, you know, significant flooding, they're going to think they're going to be fine. But again, every storm is just a little bit different, even if it hits in a very similar location. Never the same. And so how do we get the public to really understand that and seek out information that will help them make the most informed decision possible?
Yeah, like you said, you know, the Weather Channel actually, you know, it's one of the bright spots in this area. They are doing a lot better job over the past few years of those graphics. You know, as you see the storm surge, okay, you know, 6 feet of storm surge is as high as a person, 10 feet is over your first story of your house, you know, 15 feet is in the second story of your house, and then wave action on top of it. They've gotten really good about the graphics there. I don't play social scientists on TV either, but thankfully we also have social scientists in our network at the Converge Center and actually the Natural Hazards Center at UC Boulder. Dr. Lori Peek, my good friend, and just all around wonderful, beautiful person. Like, I can't gush over her enough. Her team is so excellent in social science research, pre and post natural hazard event. I highly recommend anybody who's interested in especially the social science aspect of natural hazards research to reach out to them, because they're just really excellent in that area.
Dan, she's been on my list for a while. Maybe you can give her
a nudge. She's hard to get a hold of.
I know. I've tried, but I would love to get her on the show eventually so we can see how wonderful she is. One of the things I remember about Sandy, having been deployed there mostly to do, you know, techie stuff, but we were there about the time Long Beach was putting out their trash. And, you know, it just seemed like everything these people owned was in that trash heap. And I don't know what they did with all that stuff, but, you know, that really hit home in terms of the after effects that, oh my God, they, you know, when there's water involved, you lose everything. You can't use the furniture again. Sometimes you can't use the house again.
Yep, absolutely. I remember we were living in Connecticut, both during Irene and Sandy. We actually had the eye of Irene go over our house, which is interesting. Yeah. Thankfully, our house was okay. We had a bit of generator envy and didn't have a generator at the time. But one of our neighbors lost a really big walnut tree on their house and actually gave their son a concussion. But yeah, it was it was frightening because I grew up in the Midwest. I've been through tornadoes, but never something where you stew over it for a week watching the hurricane come up the coast and like, is it going to hit? Is it not going to hit? How big is it going to be? And it hits and it's, oh my gosh, we're in this for all day, you know, wind rain. And it was just a category one. Well, I say just, but it is a huge impacting storm, and the debris impact afterwards is just incredible. In these major hurricanes, you know, as you probably saw Joe down after Laura in Louisiana, just piles of debris for miles on the, you know, turnpikes and things getting trucked out of the city to, you know, dumps everywhere. It's a really impactful logistics operation to do the cleanup.
Joe, you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, there's so many layers to that as well. You know, the logistics of cleanup are monstrous. Just the challenges of, you know, where do you put all that stuff? How do you get it there? How do you sort through it to ensure that there's no unaccounted bodies in there, and you know, things like that. I mean, there's sort of the forensic side of all of that. Matter of fact, I was talking to one of our FEMA engineers just a couple of days ago, who sent me a text from one of the hospitals in Lake Charles that we were at back during Hurricane Laura. And he's like, hey, guess where I am again? And he was down there as part of a forensic analysis of some property nearby that his engineering firm had been hired to do a forensic engineering analysis for the insurance company. And so, you know, he had a chance to see them, you know, 2 or 3 weeks apart. And after some of those mitigation efforts, and of course, now he's pulling out of the area because they're about to get hit again. So,
yeah,
you know, the same sort of challenges is that it's continuously a moving target. And it's so hard to sort of pin it down and make your statement. You know, it's almost like as of this date, here's what we predict. But tomorrow it's going to all be different again.
Yeah. And you've got the other layers of, we're in the midst of a pandemic and you have hundreds of thousands of people under a boil order for their tap water in Louisiana, and tens of thousands of those, you know, just lack water in general at the moment.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, there's the sanitation aspect of it. There's the, you know, threat of transmitting the virus in evacuation efforts, you know, and people who are, you know, normally they would be going to a shelter can't because of social distancing requirements, and they get sent on a bus a couple of states away to a hotel they can't afford because they didn't plan for that kind of thing. And now they, you know, they don't have a house maybe to go come back to. They may not have a job. They may not have insurance. And they've got to pay for a hotel somehow for the foreseeable future because they're going to get hit by a hurricane again. It's hugely impactful in a lot of these areas. That another aspect of, you know, many of the people living on the coastline are in these vulnerable populations. They're not just the rich folks with the nice beach house. It's, you know, really low income people around, especially some of the industrial areas of this part of the country. Just get absolutely devastated by storms like this.
Yeah, I actually go ahead, Joe.
Sorry, Sam. I was actually thinking about several of those nursing homes that, you know, had to be evacuated, that we assisted in evacuating. And, you know, obviously once the storm was over, they wanted to start to get those places cleaned up because they need to get those patients back in there again. But here we are, you know, 24 hours away from yet another storm on a structure, as we mentioned earlier, that's already been damaged and may well not do as well as it did the first time. And so, you know, along with there's a pandemic and all these other complications with it. So, you know, I think disasters now are, at least in 2020, have been orders of magnitude more complex and challenging to deal with, just because there are so many more factors that are involved here now.
Yeah. And we didn't even talk about climate change. You know, no matter what the cause, the ocean is warm, and that makes for rapidly intensifying hurricanes to be more of a regular thing, like we saw with Laura, like we've now seen with Delta. You know, these hurricanes can intensify in strength extremely quickly.
Thanks, 2020.
Yeah.
2020-ing. But Dan, you'll have to listen to next week's podcast, because we have a new guest coming on whose company has actually created COVID compliant shelters.
Oh, wow.
By means of, I've seen some, I'll have to send you the link, because I have some pictures of how they do that. And it's, you know, they manage to do social distancing, and they, you know, have these little cubbyhole kind of things that, that doesn't sound like it makes sense, but I'll send you the pictures to it. I think you'd
yeah, that'd be
you,
great.
I was thinking about that as I was looking at this. I go, oh, Dan's going to like this.
Yeah. And with that, I mean, if anybody out there has an idea like that, and especially if you can get the NSF to fund the research on it, you know, call up Florida International University. You can stick it in a wind tunnel.
Or, there you go.
You know, or if you want a smaller scale model of it, the University of Florida, they've got a really interesting way of tuning the wind there. You can actually have wind go across the face of a specimen there. They've got, I think, 300 and something smaller fans out of some drones. So you can kind of make eddy effects and all sorts of fun stuff. So if you want to do some research on a product that you're looking at, they do industry testing as well. But if you can, if you've got the added benefit of being a research institution that can get NSF funding, they're your people.
Ooh, sounds interesting. On a related question, I was wondering about one of the steer comments was they had to use some innovative ways for team members to adjust to activities in face of lockdowns and COVID. What do you know about that?
Yeah, their deployments. I mean, usually what they do is they'll send out a field reconnaissance team after doing a virtual reconnaissance, you know, whatever you can grab from social media posts and the news and local pictures and things like that. But they've had to adjust what they do with their field teams and have more limited deployments there are people who are, you know, within a day's driving distance, so they aren't staying overnight, and they have to be self-supported, so they aren't, you know, trying to, you know, use restaurants and facility, you know, other facilities that the people who are local will really need, and so they don't interact with the local population as well. So they're taking a lot of precautions, the steer folks, when they do their deployments this season, to make sure that they're, you know, still getting as much of the data as they possibly can, but you know, not bringing a very large team and bringing only local teams, so they aren't having to fly, things like that.
Yeah, a lot of adjustment. This whole year has been a lot of adjustment, and it'll be curious to see.
As they say in Team Rubicon, it's a semper Gumby, always be flexible.
Well, that's what we use in the federal side, too.
There you go.
Jamie, you made a comment a while ago about first responders homes. You want to mention what you were thinking?
Well, I just know, like, a good friend of our podcast, Kelly Grayson, is down in that area of Louisiana and got hit pretty hard by Laura, I know. And as far as I know, he's still waiting for final repairs to be completed in, you know, in his home. And this is coming right up that alley again. So not only, you know, do you have, you know, the average citizenry with at-risk structures, they can evacuate, but first responders are, you know, in staying in place. Maybe they're in their stations and whatnot, but their families, you know, have to evacuate, and their homes are already damaged in many cases. So
yeah,
it's a big issue for, like you were mentioning, people, you know, of lower income and stuff like that. I mean, heck, you know, our average EMTs and paramedics don't make a whole lot of money, and so their homes are reflective of that often, unfortunately.
Ooh, that's true. Thinking about you, Kelly, you know, People don't think about that, but you know, they're stretched so thin as it is, you know, on a regular everyday basis, for them to be as affected as everybody else in these scenarios, it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Becky, did you have another question? I bet you do.
I not actually at the moment. I mean, I feel like we could talk for hours, but
I know we're pushing this into a double anyway, but I'm sure you'll come up with some. Jamie, any more thoughts from you? Any questions?
You know, it's always great to have Dan on, because I think we learn so much about what goes into some of the decision making that happens after that research is done at the local level for what is building codes and what goes into the structural requirements for new construction versus renovation versus, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think it's important for us all to be aware that this kind of research is out there. And the best part about it is that it's accessible. You know, the NERI site and everything else that you can find there at designsafe.ci.org, where you can actually go and look at what's being researched and some of the data that's pulled in. So, Dan, you know, kudos to you and the whole team there for making this, you know, something that people can actually see and kind of wrap their minds around.
Yeah, props to the team down at Texas who puts that great site together. I just get to enjoy it. it's great to be part of the team that's putting it together. And while we're on the topic of the site, if anyone wants to follow along with what the researchers are doing in real time, and you'd like to get into our Slack community, if you go to designsafe-ci.org, I believe it's /community. Yeah. /community/slack-online. Anyway, it's pretty easy to find.
Jamie can put it in the show notes.
Jamie will put it in the show notes. Depending on when this comes out and how much of hurricane season is left, we do a channel for every hurricane, a specific thread of comments. And we've got teams from the University of Florida, from Oklahoma, Texas Tech, LSU, all over the place, doing different types of measurements, and they're putting out maps of where they're deploying based on the track of the hurricane, and they're putting out videos once they get set up in their hotels and they've got their sensors all set up. It's really cool to be able to see, you know, people on the ground who know what they're looking at, know what they're looking for, talking about, you know, really what's going on down there. And the beauty of Slack, you can go back and look at all the messages that have come in on a particular channel all the way back to the beginning. So if you want to see, like, oh, what really did happen in Hurricane Irma 3 years ago, we've got a channel for that. So it's really cool.
So, Joe, is it safe to assume that FEMA takes advantage of data like this in predicting the assets they're going to need?
Absolutely. You know, we actually now deploy with a GIS element that is able to provide, you know, mapping support and overlay many of the layers that we've been talking about of storm surge and, you know, local flooding, road infrastructure, identify healthcare facilities, that sort of stuff. So that data and information are incredibly important in us directing resources to where they are most needed.
Well, Dan, one of the things I was looking at too in the STEER data was all the different things they have to look at when they were doing that street view imagery. You're talking about residential, yeah, commercial construction, schools, critical facilities, industrial facilities, power infrastructure, and all of that at multiple points along that hazard gradient. That's mind-boggling.
Yeah. And this could get into a whole nother podcast that actually...
I'm sure we could.
But critical infrastructure is, well, critical. I was talking to one of our researchers, not in the hurricane sense, but he's dealing with a phenomenon called soil liquefaction. So when an earthquake hits... and there's saturated soil that's, you know, got a lot of water in it and is, you know, near a like a river or something, it actually acts like a liquid. And so whatever's underneath the ground floats, and whatever's on top of the ground sinks. And in Portland, Oregon, there is a really large transportation infrastructure hub that houses all of the fuel coming in through the port of Portland. And it's all the petrochemicals and all sorts of really nasty stuff that, you know, we need to fuel modern life in all of Oregon. And it's right next to a river on highly saturated soil. And guess what will happen when, you know, could be tomorrow, could be 100 years from now, the Cascadia subduction zone lets loose and creates a very massive earthquake out there with a large tsunami. You know, if they haven't made mitigation efforts before then, you're going to have a lot of very badly damaged tanks and burst pipes and ruptured all sorts of things. And goodness knows where all that liquid and gas is going to go and how many big fires are going to have. It's just horrific to think about. But thankfully, we have people researching that. But that's another show, as they say.
Well, we could certainly do a show on, because we're just kind of touching the outer envelope of all of this. But they're looking at future investigations, especially since the post-Rita structures in what happened in the building codes in Louisiana and so forth. But looking at the modern residential structures, especially when we're talking about garage doors, roof covers, because every time you see pictures, the roofs are flying off. Water ingress, manufactured homes, power infrastructure. And I like the last one, too. Public perceptions and assessment of building performance. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting one. And it's cool that they're looking at all of that. I'll be honest, I didn't dig far enough down into the STEER report to look at that.
Oh, okay.
So I'm glad you did. And
I'm glad they're
addressing
the
structural
it.
Stuff. But yeah, they definitely have started to incorporate not just the infrastructure aspect of it, but they bring social science into it. There's another group that's, I believe it's just SCEER. But it's social science, extreme events reconnaissance team that digs even further into that that aspect. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting when you see, you know, people who are talking about, oh well, you know, maybe it wasn't so bad, or maybe it was bad, but the perception of things really determines, or you know, is influenced by a lot of things, you know, people's past experience and, you know, like we've talked about a little bit of, yeah, I wrote out Hurricane Rita, it was just fine, but this was much worse, and I'd never do that again, kind of.
Yeah, that's what they said in Katrina, right? A whole lot of people wish they'd paid more attention.
Oh, yes.
So as much as we could keep talking for hours, I'm getting nudged here that we should probably wind this down. But we, you know, I'd love to have you back on after Delta passes through and see what you guys found out about that double whammy. That's
give us a couple of weeks to get the get the report up, and then we'll have another 115 pages to pour through to talk about. I mean,
there you go. And we're just
I just love Tracy Kajewski Correa is the PI for STEER, principal investigator for STEER. Her team is just incredible. I mean, they're all over the country. So, you know, we'll name drop a little bit there of David Roche and Justin Marshall from Auburn University led the field assessment structural team, the first one. And then a couple of guys' names who I can't even start to pronounce from LSU led the second team. So we had two teams, as well as Tracy Kajewski Correa from Notre Dame and Kurt Gurley from University of Florida, kept putting all of this report together. Just a really, really amazing job. And I'm always impressed every time I read one of these. I mean, it's, as you know, it's so thorough and really quick. I mean, the event happened on the 27th of August, and they released this 121-page report on the 14th of September. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's very amazing. You'll have to coerce some of these people to come on with you for another for another podcast.
Yeah, there's a few of them that are easier to get a hold of. Frank Lombardo from the University of Illinois would be a great one. And he's a lot easier to get a hold of than Tracy is.
Well, we'll work on that.
So, Frank, I'm calling you out. He also leads a conference when there's not COVID going on, out at University of Illinois, that focuses on wind engineering for tornado hazards. It's called.
Oh, yeah.
And I went last year. It was fascinating. And really, really great wind engineers. I see who's in awe in the chat.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who does disaster work in Chicago. I'm sure he'd love it too.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Becky, I think you have some final comments because you're still typing away over there.
No, I couldn't hear what the name of the conference was.
It is THWRTS. And I'm trying to remember the acronym. Something about Tornado Hazard Wind Assessment Reductions Symposium. They had to sneak the second T in there.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Whatever works. Huh?
Yeah. You got to make the acronym something pronounceable every now and then, which is nice.
Like SEER has the little T in it. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Joe?
It's a great conference, and it's held at the wonderful Champaign-Urbana campus whenever there's not a pandemic going on.
Yeah, there's that. So, Joe, final thoughts?
Well, I think tonight's been, you know, just a great sort of dive into the many, many, many layers of science, information, and data management that are now part of the reality of disaster response, planning, mitigation, and recovery.
Absolutely. So, Jamie, I know you love this stuff. We can't get enough of Dan, can we?
No, and I when I heard you had Dan lined up, I was really excited because we always learn so much. And not only that, but it always leads us into another opportunity to have Dan back. So, Dan, you're doing a great job.
There's never a lack of things to talk about with Dan, let's face it.
If nothing else, I'm good at providing job security for myself. So
there you go. Well, it's the storms don't stop coming, the earthquakes don't stop threatening, you know, all that stuff has
to
happen.
There's always a new hazard and always a new aspect of science around the hazards. I mean, they're, as we all know, they're impactful in so many ways, and there's a lot of heartbreak and heartache associated with them, but they are fascinating natural phenomena to study.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, one of the things that I like so much, I think the reason I like the stuff that you bring on, Dan, so much is because it's something we focus on a lot on this show, is always trying to stay on the cutting edge and always trying to look at the ways that science can be applied to the next thing. And Joe, I was thinking about you and Paragon Medical Education Group and the things you guys do, because that's something you all focus on, is always being on the cutting edge of science and being able to bring the best technologies, trying out new technologies all the time in your cadaver labs and things. I think people don't appreciate how much you guys really try to stay right on the forefront.
Well, I think, you know, based on tonight, we're going to have to double the length of our classes because there's just too much information to get across anymore.
It's true. Where can folks find you, though? Because the best thing that you all offer is a customizable experience for training and education for responders in a community. Where can they find you and reach out to Paragon to actually find out exactly how you can customize that for them?
Well, that we do, Jamie. And what we'd like is for folks to find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on our Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group, or through the Disaster Podcast, and then take a look at our information and ideas there, and then reach out to us to help us tune it to fit their needs even better.
And also, Dan, you know, I know we talked and briefly mentioned your podcast, but and we've got all the other links that I'll be putting in the show notes. But where can folks find the podcast, and what can they expect to find from the podcast?
Yeah, so the podcast is called Design Safe Radio. We're finally recording some new episodes after about a year's long hiatus. But you can hear a lot more technical discussion about, you know, what the researchers do at our different facilities. And, you know, if you're a big nerd like me, and I say that fondly, you can...
You're in a room full of nerds, Dan.
Yeah, it's, you're my people. So if you really like the technical stuff about, you know, what these researchers really do when they're studying these different phenomena in the lab or in the field and testing, that's what you'll find there. So we talk to real scientists who are doing real work, paid for by real American tax dollars. Thank you, everyone, for that. And, you know, putting our own money to work, really, in helping our society be more resilient. So it's always interesting to hear, you know, just what a day in the life of a scientist really is and how their brain works. So that's a lot of what we talk about. So Design Safe Radio on your favorite podcast platform, and the rest of everything that NERI does, you can find it designsafe-ci.org. And we've also got Facebook and Twitter as well under, I think it's NERI Design Safe or Natural Hazards Engineering. Either one of those will get you there.
Excellent. And Dan, as always, you know, the door is always open. So whenever you've got new data or things you'd like to share from NERI, you just need to ask, and we'd love to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. And yeah, I think once we get into the thick of preparing for that really big test out in California, we may need to have a couple of discussions about that, because I can't wait for the summer of 2021. It's going to be so cool.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I can't wait to hear about it myself. And I'm sure, you know, Joe is a USAR person with understanding of structural, you know, collapse and things like that. I'm sure all of us are looking forward to finding out how that fares. And we'll look forward to that coming up next year. Becky, where can folks find you, since you'll be probably retweeting and following a lot of what's going on with Hurricane Delta? Where can they find what's going on with you?
Yeah, on Twitter at WX_Bex. I use Twitter lists a lot, and I have a tropical Twitter list that's a lot of experts that are going to be tweeting a lot of really good information. So meteorologists, emergency managers, social scientists, all sorts of good stuff related to the tropical season. So definitely check that out. And then LinkedIn under Becky DePodwin, and as always, the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Yeah, and it sounds like you have a new conference you might be looking forward to once COVID lets up a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
So Sam, we're wrapping up here. Where can folks find you?
Well, I'm not the social butterfly that Becky is, but you will find me in the same places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and in our ever-growing and almost 900 person group on Facebook and disasterpodcast.com. What about you, Jamie?
Well, I'll plug the Facebook group again. We're almost to 1,000 there. I'm looking forward to getting to that milestone, and it's an active group and it's an engaged group. People really like to check in and follow up with our experts that we have on the show, and we do appreciate that. So please check out Disaster Podcast Facebook group and request to join. We'd love to have you come in and join the community there. Of course, over at disasterpodcast.com, where there are links to subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile devices, even by email if you want, just go ahead and click the button to subscribe, whichever platform you want to use, right there below the audio player at the top of every episode page. That's it for me. You can find me under the handle Podmedic in most social media locations as well. But really, check us out at the Disaster Podcast locations I just listed. Sam, good episode. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dan, it's always easy with Dan because you guys have so many questions. I just sit here and, you know, point fingers and say it's your turn. So I don't have to work a whole lot. So that's pretty cool. But one of the things that's interesting to me, too, is you've got Joe on USAR and Becky in meteorology and the stuff you and I do, Jamie, and it all interacts with what Dan's doing. And so that's why everybody gets so excited about what Dan's doing, because it does that. So I guess we can say for this episode, disaster science is not our everyday science.